This is an interview with Mr. Jack Eidelman for the Youngstown State University's Youngstown Small Business Project, interviewed by Paul Bick at Mr. Eidelman's office on October 18, 1975, at approximately 10 a.m. Mr. Eidelman, would you like to say a few things about your early childhood, what you remember about your parents and your family, where you lived, what you did day to day?
Okay, I'm a native-born Youngstownian, and my parents are also lifelong residents of Youngstown, possibly from the time of their early childhood. This early childhood part mainly pertains to my father, who moved here when he was about 10 years old. My mother came from a nearby community in New Castle, Pennsylvania, which is something like 20 miles away, so we consider ourselves natives of the area. His father brought him here from Connecticut, where they settled when they came from Europe sometime in the 1890s. And when they came to Youngstown, he told me that he attended the old Rayon School that was now, that is located on Wick and Rand and viewed by Youngstown University, I think at the present time, where the Board of Education, something in there. And when he was about 15, his father thought that that was far enough for him to go and ask him to go to work, which he did, to help support the family. He also had some brothers and sisters, some who were married at that point in time, and others who weren't, who were also working, helping to support the family. I think he told me that his brother was 11 years old when he went to work in the steel mills here in Youngstown. And they and that type of labor was used in those years. I imagine this, what we're talking about now, somewhere around the turn of the century, right? Or because I'm dating it back from my own date of birth, and I have to assume that that was the period of time he was talking about. They came to Youngstown mainly because one of his sisters married a man who eventually came to Youngstown and went into business. And since we were of Jewish extraction, he became the center of all activity here in Youngstown. This particular man I'm talking about, who I have to refer to as my uncle, but actually he married my father's sister, but he was considered an uncle by marriage. This man and his brother were in the bakery business, were well-known community people for many years, well thought of in the community, and they were responsible for settling most of the Jewish community here at that time in the early 1900s. Most of the European type of people, or most of the people that came here, somehow or another went to work for these people until they were able to strike out on their own. They were bakers. They drove bakery delivery vehicles, mostly to retail trade. There was no such thing as going to a bakery truck, going to a store and doing anything wholesale.
What was their business name?
Yeah, it was the Yazerski Baking Company. And from the Yazerski Baking Company was a man by the name of Schwebel, who who learned the baking trade with them. And I'm sure as of 1975, those residents in this area know about the Schwebel Baking Company, which was started by Mr. Schwebel after he left the employment of the Ozersky Baking Company, which failed somewhere around 1930 or 31.
Good time for failures.
That was the time when everybody failed, okay. I recall the failure of that particular bakery, the Ozersky Baking Company, and I also recall the beginnings of the Schwebel Baking Company. I can't exactly tell you what year they started the bake on their own, but I do remember quite well. And in fact, my father told me that he remembered helping in the bakery and helping at that time, not that it's such a big thing, but he said he helped the original Mr. Schwebel learn the baking business. I wasn't there to see it, but I have to assume that he wouldn't tell me that type of story if it had some merit to it. Subsequently to the bakery situation and to the schooling of my father, he decided that he would have to strike out on his own to make his own living and not work for somebody else, as he used to say. And incidentally, he always drummed that into me. Try to work for yourself. Try not to work for someone else, because you're your own man when you do it that way, and you're not when you're working for someone else. Now, that probably has some merit to it, and I've never really, on my own, worked for anyone else, except at certain periods of time when it had to be, and that was later in the Depression. I would like to tell you that my father had various and sundry businesses in Youngstown, including, I think he told me once when he first started out, he had a pool room with the then famous Warner Brothers, who went on into the motion picture business, right, downtown in Youngstown. And incidentally, they asked him if he would like to come to California when he first started. This is what he told me, and I'm sure it's so. And he thought that they were out of their tree or something, going into some kind of funny business like that, and he decided against it, which was chalk up one big fat mistake, probably, in his lifetime. And subsequently from that operation, he got into, and this is now I'm starting to remember in my own time, he had a small grocery store when I was very young, but I do remember it. Strangely enough, I have a good memory for my very, very early childhood, and I don't think I was more than 2 years old when I remember that particular thing. And that was out on what is known as West Federal Street in Youngstown, which became the Briar Hill District in Youngstown. And it was, it housed the lower working class of people at that time. I don't really think that there was a middle working class of people at that time. You were either the working class or you were not the working class, and that's who lived there. Many, many European foreign people lived in that area. And his brother also had learned the butcher trade and opened a meat market in the same area. Subsequent to that, we moved to the lower north, what is now known as the lower north side of Youngstown. And my father became and I have to use the word jitney, and I don't know if anybody knows what the word jitney is anymore in this area.
You should explain it.
But a jitney was a private passenger vehicle that usually went on a given route, like a bus, except it was a private passenger vehicle, but occasionally deviated from it from its route to accommodate its passengers or to accommodate maybe the driver's friends or something like that. And that became a pretty good business for him. And this was back around 1922. Young at that time, 5 or 6, and that business was a pretty good business for my father, who eventually owned 3 vehicles and had people driving. And this jitney business went 24 hours a day. You could always get a jitney if you stood on the corner of the route that they were going, or downtown they had a little station, which is now McKelvey's parking lot, but at that time this is where they congregated to service the public. And that's how my father started to make a living at that point. This business lasted for a few years in what is known as, at that time, as the Youngstown Municipal Bus Company. Took the jitney drivers to court, and there were several jitney drivers. Took them to court and put them out of business because they didn't conform to the, probably to what we could call the safety standards of the day or whatever it was, and the bus or the transportation company went out, and I don't think these drivers had enough money to take them further on to a higher court and so forth, and so now he had to find something new to get into. And now we're talking about 1925 or 26, and we still continue to live on the lower north side. Now the lower north side of Youngstown at that time, and this is not far from what is now Youngstown State University, but this was on Arlington Street where we live, between Belmont Avenue and Fifth Avenue, and this is the area I'm talking about, and bounded, and the residential area was bounded by Lincoln, what is known as Lincoln Avenue now, north, little bit above Wick Park, perhaps, and sparsely settled above Wick Park for a few years until its more population moved in, and then it became much more built up. There were many, many people of all extractions that lived in this area, bounded by Lincoln Avenue to through Wick, up to Wick Park, or let's say slightly above Wick Park, as I remember, as I recall. And most people got along well with each other. Many ethnic groups lived together, and I can't really remember any particular problems that people thought about in those years. And it was also the years that no one was afraid to go out at night, any time of the night, and nobody felt threatened at any time that I can remember. I started the school, public school at Elm Street School at the time. One of the outstanding people in those days, in my memory, was the principal of the school, who was a very, very fine, regal-looking woman named Catherine Edmonds. She was a well-known educator in Youngstown, who drove an electric car, one of the few electric cars in the city. Now, for two reasons I knew about the electric car. One, because she drove it, naturally, and we liked her. But secondly, that my father, at that point, was also in the service station business on the corner of Belmont and Arlington Street, in addition to being in the jitney business, because it kind of tied up with each other. He could put gasoline in his own vehicles and so forth. And Miss Edmonds was always driving the electric car, and when she used to come in to get air in it, Maybe Aaron. I don't remember. I think maybe that car had had pneumatic tires instead of, you know, I don't know. But she used to drive into the station once in a while, and my father thought very highly of her, and there was a mutual feeling between them. And so we remember, always remember the electric car because she didn't buy gasoline from us. Miss Edmonds was, as I mentioned before, was a very outstanding person. And she knew all of her students by their first name. She never forgot them. And you could go back there 20 years later, maybe, and she still remembered who you were and could tell you incidents that happened at that time. Now, I say this because it was many years later when I used to go back to visit once in a while. And I mean, over a long span of time, she always remembered certain little incidents that happened at the time. I also remember that none of the teachers, I don't say this because of I was a youngster going to that particular school, but most of the teachers that I had to be women past in their 40s or older at that time. Because I can remember that they were I thought, grandmotherish type of people. And I don't think it was just because I was a youngster, I say this, but they were quite old. I remember when one of those teachers died many years later, a very outstanding woman by the name of Nesbitt. Her last name was Nesbitt, and I think Nesbitt Street in Poland was named after her family. And she died in her 80s, and that wasn't that many. I could tell from the time I went to school to the time she died that she was probably in her 50s when I was a youngster in school. But I will say this, that most of those teachers that I had were very outstanding people with children. I don't know if this still exists in schools today. I'm not familiar with it, but I know that we thought a lot of our teachers and respected them very highly. And I think that part of the teachers' personalities had to do with the principal of the school, whom I remember as really being just the most marvelous type of person who really cared about her kids. Well, I went through 4 years to fourth grade at Elm Street School when my father decided that he couldn't exist doing what he was doing, and he was doing many things now at this point because I think my father just really couldn't find himself. He was never financially well off, and many things that he did out of desperation. But we finally moved to the south side of Youngstown, and I transferred to another school, which is known now as Sheridan School. It was Sheridan School then. I moved into the fourth grade in Sheridan School. And the reason I mention this now at this point is that there was a difference in the school, in the teachers at that time. Now the teachers became much younger, not because I got older, but the teachers really were much younger than they were at Elm Street School. And the principal at Sheridan School was also a very good friend of Catherine Edmonds, the principal of Elm Street School, and they had like personalities. And her last name was Irey, Irie. And she seemed to have a similar type of personality to the principal of Elm Street School, which was probably, maybe that's why they were such good friends, I don't know. However, her staff at Sheridan School was younger, but the teachers still had good relationships with their students. But now we're talking about the year of around 1928, I think, and my father opened a convenience type of store on the, not far from where we're talking now, a few blocks down the street. And this was the, we remained there for many years, attempting to make a living there. But as you know, you've heard about the crash of 1929, the stock market crash, and the depression, and so forth. And we had some real tough sledding through those years. I could go, I could tell you that the neighborhood that we now moved into was, should have been what you, we would call the middle class working area, where most people owned their homes. Not all of it, most people were buying their homes, I should put it that way. The neighborhood was of a better construction than the one on the lower north side, probably because the homes were newer. I don't think the people were that much different, but the homes were newer because the area was a newer area. And the school system, or the school was newer, maybe that's why people were moving into that area. Most of these people, again, were either working in the steel mills, some of them were self-employed professionals, attorneys and physicians, who in those days physicians were in the $150,000 salary bracket. So, and that's who lived in that neighborhood. And speaking of physicians, I can remember the physician that we used to have, who when he got sick, he came to our house. Now, when the doctor came to your home, he generally didn't give you a prescription either. Not generally. He carried his own medicine with him, and no matter what ailed you, he always had to reach in his black bag and come up with some kind of a pill or liquid or something to make you feel better, at least what he thought was the right thing. It really was in those years that that there was such a thing as house calls, and you expected a physician to come to your home. There wasn't any such thing as come to the office. And if he ordered you into the hospital at that time, which is a rarity in most cases, you had to be dying before they sent you to the hospital. Today, people don't have time for that kind of thing. Well, go to the hospital and spend the weekend there, and maybe you'll feel better Monday morning or whatever it is.
When you were talking about living on the near north side, you spoke about the, what shall we say, the good feeling and good, well-integrated nature of the neighborhood, well-integrated in the sense that a lot of distinct or various ethnic types seemed to live together in harmony. Was there any difference when you moved to the south side? Did you notice that moving from one type of neighborhood to another, different types of atmosphere? Was there any, what shall I say, attitude change among your neighbors?
I'm glad you brought it up, because I should have mentioned it. Yes, definitely. Since we are of Jewish extraction and took that particular storeroom, there was a definite change. There were people who only referred to it, and I used to hear this because I played with the children or the boys in the area. Now where I'm getting a little older, now I'm talking about I'm 12, 13 years old or something like that. So this is where you're hanging around on the streets playing ball, or the empty lots playing ball. We really didn't play much in the street. And even if you did, it wouldn't have mattered so much because there wasn't really that much traffic. But, or I'd get to somebody's house and I could hear somebody's mother say, go down to the Jews and get a loaf of bread. And I had never heard that before. And it kind of was taken aback by it. I've heard it a lot since that time, and it doesn't bother me as much as it used to, but at one time, that used to bother me, and I used to think, well, why don't they refer to my father as Charlie, because everybody used to call him Charlie, and he was really
My father was a very likable man. He was a popular type of person. He could identify with a lot of people. he had a very kind heart. And as bad as things were in those years, I could tell you some stories about that too, and which I think are really, it pictures him, it's true, but it's still, I think there were a lot of people in his generation who were like that. When we had the store, we normally sold penny candies, as those, I don't know if, well, people, there are no penny candies today, but there was penny, people, kids used to come in and could put their nose up against the showcase and take 45 minutes to pick out one penny or two pennies worth of candy because they had decisions to make, and there were 35 different kinds of penny candies, and you know, it was pretty tough when you only have 1 or 2 cents. But I don't think there was ever a kid who came in that store that didn't have a penny and looked in that thing longingly and then said finally, I just looked, I didn't have any money. Whoever went out of there without something in their pocket, my father just was the kind of person that would do that. Which I don't particularly think that was great business, but he couldn't. He just was always crazy about children, the little ones. When they got a little bigger, he wasn't so that, because they could give him a hard time. But the little ones never went away from there without something in their pocket, even if they didn't have money to buy it. So that I would think that when those references were made to him by some mother who said, yeah, go down to the Jews and get a loaf of bread or a quart of milk or whatever, that it was just because there was a feeling that there was some type of prejudicial feeling that I just at the time couldn't understand, because I don't think that my father and mother, who were born here in this country, who had American, let's assume, American ways and so forth, that type of language should just never happen. And it used to hurt me when I was of this age to feel that some of these people would do it. Well, it wasn't one particular person who did this. I used to hear it from other people, or people would not come in for that very reason. Say, no, I wouldn't. I could hear people, kids say, well, we don't come to you because of that, for that reason. So there was a change. However, there were many people who came in and said just the opposite. Said, no, God, I don't care what you are. We like you for what you are. Okay. And they traded with us and so forth. Now we didn't make a great living up there, but we just kind of existed through that depression years, and continued to go to school and so forth up there. In fact, the matter is, existed. My gosh, we couldn't even get the bus fare in the city. At that time, you could buy a weekly pass and get on the bus, and we could buy a weekly pass for 75 cents. Maybe it was 50 cents at one time. I mean, you could have unlimited rides for 50 cents. And the people that bought that was those that were working maybe 3 days a week, which was a lot of work at that time. This was depression years. Well, it got to the point where I couldn't even ask my mother to give me car fare to downtown. We just didn't have it. No one had it. We finally got a bright idea one day. We used to buy the weekly pass for 50 or 75 cents, and we ran it out. Yeah, you did. That's how you, but you know, really, you did. You bought it because you could, you know, we would take out that 50 or 75 cents and go buy maybe, or maybe we'd take $1.50 and buy 2 passes. And somebody would come over and say at 10 o'clock in the morning and say, well, they want the pass until noon. And they'd be back at noon, and you'd give them the pass, say, for a dime, for 10 cents. For those 2 hours, and then somebody come in at say from 1 and take it from 1 to 4 or whatever they take it for, they want to go shopping, they pay another 10 cents. So, you know, you're really getting 20 cents for the pass, and then in the evening, maybe the pass was yours if you wanted to go down somewhere on the bus or do a little transportation.
Well, if you rent the thing out 6 days a week for, or even seven, but let's assume 6 days a week and got 20 cents a day, you got $1.20 for an investment of 75 cents or 70 cents or 50 or whatever it was. So you didn't lose out. Everybody benefited by it. The person who rented it and us. So, okay. And yet it was the only way to go downtown. And I'd have to wait till no one was using the pass that day, and my mother would give it to me. And then we used to have another little gimmick, too. Somebody would get on the bus especially in the summertime, somebody would get on the bus with a pass, sit right down and throw the pass out the window. And somebody else would pick the pass up, you know, your friend that was with you, and he'd either wait for the next bus or you could run. It's according to the route we're talking about. But I remember one route, if you ran east, the bus used to go south and then go east and then come back north. And you'd beat the thing by taking the pass and running due east to the street that the bus was going to come south on eventually. And you'd get on that bus too. I mean, this is how it was done. And you just did everything. I can remember when theaters here used to run this was before we moved to the south side, but I was a youngster then, when the movies were the thing, like television first came, but was the movies were the thing, and for 5 or 10 cents, probably a dime, I think it was, we used to go to a show in the morning, and they'd have a special show for kids at 10 o'clock in the morning, and I must have been maybe 6 or 7 at that time, and when for a dime, you used to go in and get a bag of candy. They gave that to you when you bought your ticket, and walked in, and they kind of do bag of candy, and we went inside and sat down and watched the silent for maybe they ran a comedy for you and a cereal. You know what a cereal is?
Yes.
Okay, they would run a cereal, weekly cereal. You saw the part of the weekly cereal, and then they ran the movie. So when you went in the theater at 10 o'clock and got that bag of candy and sat down to watch all of this movie thing I told you about, it was over like at 1 or 1:30. But I don't think I ever left the theater before 7 or 8 o'clock at night, and that was when my mother used to come down looking for me, wondering what happened. After she checked with all the neighbors and so forth, this is how it was. That was years before we moved to the south side. But when we would come down on this bus pass type of thing, we would go down and really movies went to 10 cents most of the time, 10 cents, and that was when the first double feature ever came into existence. There was no such thing as a double, two full-length movies until those depression years. And so in order to attract people, they used to have a 10-cent movie, usually during the day, and it'd give you two full-length movies plus a few other odds and ends, like a comedy or something like that, which pretty well showed what was happening to people. They didn't have anything to do, and even 10 cents was hard to come by sometimes, just to go to a movie. But with kids, sometimes you found money on the street. Ah, you could, you know, sometimes they say you could go to the movie, or you could earn it by the hard way, you know, shoveling snow maybe, or cutting grass and all that kind of thing. And you did that type of thing. Well, we kind of survived the depression, as most people did. And when things started to get a little better, people started to go back to work, and people started to pay off their old debts. And most people did that. At least they tried. You very seldom heard about somebody who said, well, we're just too far into it, let's declare bankruptcy and wipe everything off. Many of them, just didn't feel that was the way to play the game. And bankruptcies were, you know, from a business standpoint, were generally for the huge businesses, and those were businesses huge, we call businesses, let's say, that had a net value or
net worth of $25,000, a huge business, huge, because most of the little mom and papa stores that my mother and father were involved with were, I don't think our inventory was more than $1,500 or something like that, so $25,000 sounded like a lot of money. But we were, but we got caught into that depression type of thing too, and got behind with our creditors, but for many years, my father, after the things started to get better, would not, in his own way, wouldn't go bankrupt. He just wouldn't do it, and eventually paid off everybody he owed. And incidentally, that for him, and I think it's quite interesting that even though he incurred the debt, say, in the 30s, somewhere in the 40s, he had everybody paid off. And I remember one time I went with him. Now I'm a young man. I was home on leave from the Army, and we went into a certain place to where he was buying or something. And he told these people that he wanted to pay off the old bill. The place is still in business in Youngstown area, old timers here, called Frankel Brothers. He told Frankel Brothers, I owe you an old bill, and I want to pay it off. Pay it. Somebody from Frankel Brothers looked at it and said, you don't owe us anything. Because my father had continued to do business with these people, first on a cash basis, and later when things got better, was back on in their good graces for credit again. And never said anything to him about the old account, but he knew about the old account. And I'm talking about, let's say, we're talking about $200 to $300, if I remember correctly, that he still felt he owed them, and I'm sure he did. And when he said he wanted to pay them, now he's in pretty good shape. And he comes in and says, I want to pay him, and I have to be with him. And they said, you don't owe us anything, because we wrote that off back in 1938 or whatever it was. We just wrote it off. So, you know, so we wrote it off as debt that was no longer owed. And he insisted on paying me. And they were such also good businessmen. They really didn't want to take it from me. They really didn't. They said, no, we wrote it off, and, you know, that's it. But he really argued about it. I remember this quite well. They argued about it. The guy didn't want to take his money because he didn't feel anymore that it was old, it was too old, and my father insisted that his conscience wouldn't be clear unless he paid it. They didn't, and he wouldn't strike a compromise. He knew how much he owed, and he paid it. Now, we're talking about the early 40s, like 41 or 2 or whatever year that was, and he insisted on paying it off, and he did. Incidentally, he had now changed his business once again and had moved to the outskirts of Youngstown on the north side of Youngstown, and into a different business, and he was doing much better financially in those days.
What was he doing?
Now he opened up a bar and restaurant, or he bought out a bar and restaurant which was a business that I never had any particular love for. In fact, the matter is, I disliked it quite a little bit, and I didn't even want to have any part of it. But he liked it. He said he did, and he worked at it for 8 or 9 years before he decided he had enough of it too. But in the meanwhile, he did well financially there and was able to accumulate some property and so forth. Now things, of course, have changed in Youngstown, too. Neighborhoods were building up even before World War II, talking about. The south side of Youngstown was extending. Boardman became a force as such. Austintown wasn't doing anything yet at that time, if I can remember. Austintown really didn't become alive until the early part of the 50s. There were things happening there, but not anything near to what happened on the later time. And other communities were springing. Now, I'm going to digress and go back just slightly. From my own standpoint, after I continued on school and went on to South High School in Youngstown. And when I, and at the time I graduated, my, I had intended to go on to higher education, and but was still somewhat depressed economy, and I know many kids who, as of later times, who somehow or another made it through university, even in, with depression and without even any self-help, any help from their parents. I just didn't think I could make it. I was a little afraid to make it, so I never went on to have to for higher education at that point. And I was interested in music at that time, and I did want to go on. I did feel I had some talent to go on what is known as the stage. Okay, I'm a little Hamlet, a little bit of a Hamlet. Anyhow, my father always at that he always discouraged it. He'd tell me there are too many unemployed people as it is without having another one added to the rolls when I could be maybe doing something productive for myself. And I did. I found something to do. Not much, but it paid pretty well for those years. And I worked at it. Now I'm working for somebody. Okay. And I was driving a delivery truck in what is known in the laundry and dry cleaning business. And I worked at that maybe a couple of years, and I decided that I could do the same thing for myself, and being somewhat of a broker. And I found somebody to do the dry cleaning for me, and somebody to do the laundry for me, and I think when I was about 20 or so, I was now out on my own. I think I called myself the Crown Laundry and Dry Cleaning Company, and I didn't own the dry cleaning plant, nor did I own the laundry, but at least I went out and did it. And my father, this was before my father had moved to the north side, but anyway, he decided he wanted to go up to the, take over that bar on the north side, and he didn't know what to do with the mom and pop store he had, because he was still in debt at that time, and he felt that it wasn't, you just don't close out one thing and go into something else and leave your creditors wondering about you. So I had, he asked me to bail him out a little bit. Now, not bail him out financially, but to run the operation, continue running the operation and see if I could pay off part of that debt and so forth and so on, which is what I did. And I stayed up there in this neighborhood that I was a little afraid of. Not afraid, I was never, I don't mean that type of threat that I'm talking about today of being held up. I don't mean that type of thing. I'm talking about the neighborhood where people weren't so sure that they wanted our kind of people in its neighborhood. But anyway, I went through that.
Well, we've got you being a grocer at this point, and now you're an insurance salesman, an independent insurance agent, right now in 1975. When did you get into the insurance business, such as it is? What brought you into it? What struck your interest and things of that sort?
Okay, that's a good question. I'm glad you brought it up if you're interested in it, because I never even thought about telling that particular phase of something. But after doing service, and I came back to, I came back home, and all that type of thing, I met my wife, and she insisted that I ought to go back to and pick up an education that I denied myself some years before. So I did, and when I graduated, I took up the accounting field. When I graduated, from the university. I didn't really like very much the accounting field anyhow. I just didn't like it. However, along with general business and other type of things, I went into men's haberdashery business. And I stayed in it for some years, and I didn't feel it was really that productive either. In the meantime, we had children born into our union, and my children are now growing older, and I've now purchased our first home, and it's going to get too small, and here I am sitting in this business. In the meantime, we decided to build another home, and we did. Eventually to sell the home, our original first home. And I find myself in a business that's growing smaller instead of larger due to, one, location, two, the advent of the shopping plazas, which are now starting to siphon off much of the trade. And it was when I went to a bank one day and saw a man in railroad in overalls and stuff like railroaders wear, making a kind of what looked like a big deposit into a checking account or saving, whatever it was he was making. He was standing in front of me. He puts this huge amount of money in. At that time, it looked good, like something like $1,200 or $1,500, which is still a pretty good amount of money. And when he left, I asked the manager of the bank who that guy was. So he told me, oh, he works on the railroad, but he's also in the insurance business.
I said, you're kidding.
Yeah, he said, well, he's had a lot of years in the railroad, and he's only in the insurance business part-time. I said, yeah, but he put a lot of money in there. No, he says, he's doing real well in the insurance business. And to me, insurance always meant something where you went from door to door and collected 35 cents a week or whatever it was, because I just really never took any interest in insurance business, even though I had probably had a course of insurance somehow, some way along the line through undergraduate work, you know. But I never really looked at it that seriously, and then I started to realize that, hey, maybe this might be something that I would like. But I still didn't know anything about it, but I decided that I would look into it, which I did. And meantime, I have now got my oldest son, who's about 16 at that stage of the game, and I think to myself, well, he's going to have to go to college shortly. And I had one a year and a half behind him, and one 10 months behind the middle one, and they're all going to be in school at the same time, and where am I going to get funds to do that unless I make a change parental? You know, sometimes you have a tiger by the tail. You know, you have something, and you're afraid to hang on, and you're afraid to let go, and here I've got this business that's going for me, and I don't know how to get out, and I don't know if I get out, if I'm going into something that's going to provide me with something. But I have after researching the insurance business and not saying that I really knew marketing that well, I thought that maybe I had a new idea about how to sell insurance. I thought I did. And I pursued the idea. And it kind of worked out for me pretty well. And I've remained in it since. Well, we've made some changes in my first thinking about it. And I've been in the insurance business now for quite a few years, but even it does provide me a good income, has provided me a good income. And I was able to send all my children through school, and as it turned out, one of them is now a practicing physician, and another one has
building contractor, and the third one is a library. And the children are successful, and we feel that the insurance business provided this type of, provided the help that we needed to do all of this for them. Now, in addition to that, of course, my wife, who came to this country as an immigrant at age 2, perhaps, slightly under 18, 19 months, but her family were immigrants from Russia. And I think they came to this country in 1923. I was an accomplished cellist at quite an early age, 19 or 20, sure. They were very proficient. And when I met her, she was playing in an engagement here in Youngstown with a group of people. And after we married, she came here, and she too had employment with as much employment as musicians could get in, even in those years, even today. She has played with the Youngstown Philharmonic Orchestra, which provided slight income. And she taught privately, which provided very little income, really. But she did, but between the two of us, and doing other things and trying everything we could, we're able to, along with then changing the insurance business and so forth, we're able to raise our family, become somewhat more independent than we formerly were.
Well, through this period of being an insurance agent and doing various and sundry other things, I assume you've had an opportunity to encounter a lot of people, and are there any figures of politics or local business or things of that nature that you can recall anything anecdotal about or interesting about or perhaps personal about that may be enlightening over this period, say?
Yeah, as I recall, in the early 20s, and I was really young at the time, but I do remember, the mayor was elected here in Youngstown, that his name was George Olds, and he was a real straightforward, outright businessman who decided he was going to make the city of Youngstown an honest, decent place to live. He felt there was too much politicking going on. There's still too much politicking going on today, but he felt that he could do something about it. But he encountered such difficulties with politicians that, I don't know, it was a matter of probably 2 months or so that he resigned the mayorship here, simply because he just didn't feel he was ready to hassle with all these politicians. So other people took over as city fathers, so to speak. And as I can recall, all through the Depression, there was so much graft and dishonesty in local politics that as I look back, of course I was young to look back, at me, I was in my young years, and as I look back now, I wondered why people stood for it. But I guess people stand for it all the time anyhow. They stood for Nixon, and until somebody caught him, and they stood for, and they're standing for all of the, probably something is wrong in the city of New York at the present time, which is caused by whatever. Most of it, I'm sure, is because of somewhere along the line. There hasn't been it just hasn't been a straight shot by all those that are in power and so forth. But this is what happened here in those years, as I remember, and the people still went along with it. Listen, I can remember when Youngstown, when things got so bad here that the city of Youngstown printed script. You know what script is?
Vaguely. What
vaguely.
You
well, script was that all of a sudden the city didn't have any money, and they started to issue their own money, and they called it script, and they would pay off their workers in script, which was really a promise to pay. Really, that's what this thing was. But they had it in denominations, $1 ones and $5 ones and so forth. And merchants were asked to honor the script from those that had it and got paid with it and use it like money until the city had money to redeem it. And they did. We used to accept script in our place, but a lot of times we couldn't buy anything with it. Some of our suppliers, say, for example, said, we don't want anything like that. Now, the local supplier would do it. He would take it because he was part of the community and had to do it. Not had to, I mean, he felt it was his duty to do it. And he took it. But if you had to buy from an out-of-town supplier, Pennsylvania supplier or something, they weren't about to take script. They wanted hard U.S. currency or paper currency, but they wanted it that said government money.
How long did that go on? Was that a recurrent thing, or did it have a regular span to it?
Well, I think it went on for... I think it was just like, let's use the word, an indefinite period until the city... This is probably... I think they started to do this about the 35 or 36. I'm not certain on those dates. Right. But I think by the time of 38 or 39, the city was already redeeming script, you know, to those that helped.
Well, there must have been a fair amount of it floating around for quite a while.
I imagine there was. They used to pay their workers part in script and part in cash. You didn't get all your money in script, but you did get some of it. And this is how the city operated for a while. Probably that was all, and then there were a lot of foreclosures during those periods too by the banks. And I'll tell you, I don't really think so, and that's just in my opinion, I don't think the banks really wanted to foreclose on people, but I don't think they had any choice. And at one time I understood a couple of the savings and loans or banks, I'm not sure which ones, had so much property that they had to take. See, people would turn them back. I don't think they really wanted to do it. I think they would try to work out anything with people, or they would just say, okay, we'll forego your principal if you just try to pay on the interest or whatever. And I don't think people could even do that, so that all of a sudden many of these institutions acquired or accumulated a lot of property that they almost didn't know what to do with in those years. And people were living in homes that were like I mentioned some time before, that they were buying or paying on, and they just couldn't pay. Many of them were able to retain it. Many of them just gave up, and many people who had a little money were able to buy property. Let's use the word. That were had residences on it, and even some business property for next to nothing. And later, over many years later, went at a resale, made quite a little bit of money on that. But in that period, this goes back to the city script again, I think the city was issuing the script because people weren't even paying the real estate taxes, which resulted in no money in the city treasury. Also in those years is when we had a governor by the name of, I think it was Governor Davey, who initiated in the state the first sales tax, which was only supposed to last for a short period of time, like 2 or 3 years or whatever, and then there wouldn't be any more sales tax. Well, that was also a political promise. here it is, 1975, and that's probably some 35 or 40 years later. We not only have the sales tax, we have an additional 1% over what it originally was to begin with. Maybe it's a 2%. I don't remember if the first sales tax was 2% or 3%. I think it was only 2%, but I'm really not certain on that. And all of this with not too much protest from the populace or the citizens at that time, I don't think people were as politically aware of what's happening as they are today. I don't even know if they are today, but I think that they're more aware of what's happening to them from a political standpoint than they were in the late 30s and early 40s, as I recall. The city also was, going back to the late 20s was when people first became aware of what is known as, quote, unquote, gangsterism.
Right.
Al Capone became, you know, the legendary character. He was almost a hero to many people. And we didn't know anything about, it was termed at that time, the Black Hand, and they never used the word mafia, I don't remember at that time, but they did use the word Black Hand and other names for organized crime. But Al Capone was the Chicagoan who became famous for this kind of thing. Now, in those years, we in this country, the people in this country at that time, went ahead and let the Volstead Act become law, which, as you know, was prohibition, what is known as prohibition. Now, this created a lot of things. First place, we had what is known as a speakeasy. Now we have speakeasies today, but a little different. But here's a speakeasy where you had to know somebody and get you in, and you could, get buy whiskey and so forth. And I can remember people making, this is what I do remember. In those years, I remember people making what is known as home brew. And they would make their own beer. And a lot of times you read about the person's still blowing up in their house. The beer thing was something would explode, and usually put in the paper that the guy was making root beer, but he really wasn't. but that people were doing it, and people were drinking a lot of alcohol, probably they shouldn't be, because it wasn't safe to drink, and there was all this blindness and stuff that was happening, and was happening right here in Youngstown. Okay, I mentioned it because it was in those years that a lot of things had happened. We had a lot of prostitution in Youngstown in the 30s. We had a big red light district where that the police turned their back on. We had a lot of speakeasies that the police turned that the law enforcement officials, let's say, turned their back on. We had we were in the numbers business here. Numbers business flourished real well here. It was just an open thing. It later became known as the bug. Everybody said, what's the bug number for the day? And somebody said, well, the number was 683. And if you had bet on 683, you were a winner. Okay. Every little store, and even ours, was writing the bug. And it became people, they how they got their kicks. You can go down for a penny and play a penny on a number, and you might win $5. For a penny, that was a lot of money. $5 for one. The bug usually paid $500 to 1 was generally the payoff. So if you bet a dime on the number, you just get a chance to win $50. Played a dollar on a number, which many people might have, could win up to 500, maybe a little more. See, so if you're lucky, well, of course, now you have from 1 to 999, or from 100 to 999, all those numbers in between to pick it up. But anyway, that was the game, and everybody did it.
Everybody played it, even those people who swore on Sunday that gambling was bad, was back on Monday playing that game because they didn't figure that was anything so terrible. Really, it just showed you the standards of people's, and I think they have that kind of standard even today, many of us. But they were back playing this thing. Well, somebody about 1932, as I remember in Youngstown, invented, I think, for his own amusement, what it was then known, I don't know what words they use now for it, but was then known as the wiffle board. And what was the wiffle board? The wiffle board, I remember the guy, because he was my neighbor, or was a neighbor of ours, who made this thing. And what it was a game, he tacked some nails around some little holes in a board, maybe 2x5 or something like that, and it had a little spring thing on it, and you put a marble in front of the spring thing and let the spring thing go and see if you could get the marble into a certain scored number. The higher the score, the more it paid off. It became known as a marble board, which eventually became known, became coin-operated over the... His game became coin-operated, which eventually led to some of those things being put into stores and pool rooms and so forth, and people go down, and that's how they got their kicks. For 5 cents, they got 10 marbles to shoot out of there, and then you gave them a prize on the sly if they got a certain score of something or more. The more they got, and all these kind of things, and eventually these games became electrified with electrical energy, that type of thing. And today you see them, they got all kind of lights flashing and this type of thing. But this started in Youngstown. It really did. It was the home of the, I don't know if that's something you can really take credit for, but it was really the home of the first marble, because they used marbles in those days. Now they use steel balls and other things, but it was the first, they used to use just plain, what the kids used to play, marbles. And they used those in this game, and it became big business. It really did. Became big business throughout the country. At a later time, of course, the whole operation then moved to Chicago, and you probably would know why, because I think, besides being in the bootleg game, I think the Mafia was also, or the Black Hand or whatever it was, also became interested in this thing, because they could see a lot of potential dollars in it. But I don't know if Youngstown should claim anything out of this, but this type of business.
What was this fellow's name? Do you recall?
I can't recall his name. I cannot recall his name now, but I remember his doing it, and he called it the head Wiffle Company. Wiffle. Well, I don't know where he got that name either. Whiffle, I think it was, and he called it Wiffle Company, and it used to say on that game, it used to say Wiffle Company, Youngstown, Ohio. You know, there was a glass on top of this thing, so that, you know, and people used to do, well, we got one in our, my father got one in his store, I remember, and next thing you know, we had three of them in there, because people used to stand around, and that's how they got their kicks, and put a nickel in the machine and shoot these things, and then, like I say, when they finally got electric to it, of course, it made it a big, you know, a lot of things happened all by itself, lights flying all over the place and this kind of thing. But the police officials also let that go, even though it was somewhat a form of gambling, it was. And then there were protests there's always a group of people that are going to protest something like this because of the moral or whatever it is. And they even participated in themselves. So between the prostitution and the bootlegging and the people making their own stuff at home and the marble boards and its concessions and and the bug. Youngstown was quite an interesting city, and in all those years, I really think that that little excitement made for a little bit of prosperity for somebody. It just had to, because there was, they seemed to be able to drum up a nickel or a dime for this kind of thing.
Well, we've almost used up an hour's worth or so of time. Is there anything you'd like to say, anything that you sort of would like to add that for some reason or another we haven't crossed over that is important to you personally? Anything that you'd like to mention stands out in your mind?
Actually, I think many of the events that I've told you about were especially important in my life span, because if they weren't, I wouldn't be bringing them up
right.
to me. So those were important. I'm sure that there are many more important things that happened in the city of Youngstown that didn't seem important to me at this point, which I'll probably remember later. But at this point, I don't think so. And